We'd like to welcome you to the virtual kitchen table. We are Haley from Taking a Kinder Path, Ashley from Ashley as Mama and Storytime Shelves, and myself, Erin, from Everlearning. We're gathering to have conversations about family life and home education, most specifically unschooling, which is sometimes known as self-directed education, or as I often refer to it, whole life learning. We'll be sharing experiences and ideas, learning as we go. We hope you'll pull a chair up to the table and join us. Welcome back to the virtual kitchen table. It's Erin here today, and I have April Scully from Modern Homeschoolers. Nice to see you again, April.
Hi, Erin. Thanks. Great to see you too.
Yeah. And Sue Elvis from Stories of an Unschooling Family. Hello, Sue.
Hi, Erin. Hi, April. And this is going to be a really good conversation. I'm really pleased that you chose me to join in with it because unschool maths is my thing.
Yes. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it too. And Sue, we're going to have to figure out. I got thinking before. So we're talking about unschooling math. And so for you and Haley, Sue, it would be maths, because I know in the UK, Australia, New Zealand, you have the S. In Canada, it's math without the S. April, without the S for you in the States, right?
Correct.
Right. Maybe
I was just about to say that, and I was about to apologize because I'm going to be using the S because it just rolls off my tongue. And the reason I wanted to apologize was because I was having a Facebook conversation many, many, many years ago about maths, and somebody stopped by and criticized my spelling and said, "Why do I keep calling it maths?" And she lived in America. And I had to explain to her that we have different customs here. And she was unaware of that. So it's funny, isn't it, how something so natural for us, you assume the whole world knows, but quite often other people don't. And then it irritates them because they think you're making a mistake all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny in Canada that we do the American pronunciation, but a lot of our spelling is British spelling. So it's funny that this is one area that we differentiate, but I guess I could have just said mathematics and then that.
You know, I love that we're starting with this because it just happens that my Instagram story from about an hour ago was, I was listening to the podcast episode with Ruth and Missy from Let 'Em Go Barefoot. And I happened to be listening to it with my six-year-old daughter. So she was listening along and her first question was, "Why does she say maths?" And it was so actually enjoyable to me to be able to stop and say, "She says that because she lives in England." And, you know, it was fun to just have that natural conversation with her and have her learn this, to your point, Sue, you know, at such a young age, so that when she hears that now for the rest of her life, she's going to know why some people use math and some people use maths. And I don't think I learned that actually until the last couple of years. I didn't know that when I was younger. Even with the traveling that I've done, I think maths did not come up in conversation, apparently.
Well, that might be interesting to the conversation, April, that given all your travel, that the idea of talking about maths or mathematics out of context of life is not that common.
Right. So, exactly. It's funny, isn't it?
Fit in with our, I think the first time I was aware of it was we used to enjoy a lot of the Usborne books, which are from England. And so that's when I started noticing it. But then I realized that Australia, and I think New Zealand does as well. So yeah. Well, anyway, listen, if Missy and Ruth manage their conversation with the American and English, then we'll do just fine.
We got this.
Yeah, exactly. And so we are sad to be missing both Haley and Ashley today, who are, neither of them are well. And I was just saying to Sue when we first logged on that I feel like there's enough to talk about with math, or there has to be, because Sue has
when I did a search on Sue's webpage, it was multiple blog posts. So there has to be enough to talk about, but I'm sure that there will be a chance for them to pop on about this topic at some point. But I wondered, I think we talked about maybe kind of beginning the conversation by thinking about what was each of, what maybe what were some of our memories or what was each of our experience with math. I can begin unless anybody else is jumping up. Nope. Okay. So I was thinking about this last night because it's not something that you think about very much. I feel like reading people talk about that more when they learn to read, because it maybe feels a little bit more like I can remember myself as a pre-reader versus a reader, you know, and I think maybe it feels a little bit more like there's a distinction there. And people talk about that. They can pretty much say when around the age that their child learned to read, but math is different, isn't it? It's not something that you kind of learn to do. It's just, it's a different process. So I was thinking about how, when I was in elementary school, I liked math. I don't have any that I can think of. I don't have any sort of negative feelings, negative experiences or memories around math. I liked it. I felt reasonably good at it. I think those years up to 11, 12, where it was more, more the concrete math, you know, so operations and arithmetic and fractions and decimals. I like all that stuff. So that was interesting to me, interesting enough. I don't remember loving it, but I remember liking it well enough. It was never something I thought too much about. And I remember feeling really confident in math. And so here would be grade 5. So I was probably like 10 or 11. Things like multiplication tables came quickly to me. I loved fractions, all that stuff. And then when it got into the more abstract math, I felt less confident. And I hear a lot of people say this, but I think I was used to doing fairly well in school until that point. So when I started to have questions or I felt like I'd missed information, like I'm going to think like high school math, secondary school math, it's almost like a fog came over me. So it was like a few things I didn't understand. I think elementary school math, it was almost like putting language to what I already knew, if that makes sense. You know, it was like I understood things like multiplication and division. It was just putting language to them, but it felt like learning a new language somehow when you got into the more abstract stuff. And I kind of felt like maybe I missed some of the early instruction if I wasn't listening or what was going on. And then it felt like it snowballed a little bit, and it suddenly became something in my head that felt kind of ominous. And I won't say that I had I don't think it was massively upsetting for me, but I do remember feeling like I'd lost my grip with it, kind of. And I was just sharing with Sue briefly before we popped on that I started French immersion when I was about 11. That was our school board. A lot of places, they start from the beginning or, you know, maybe grade 1. But our school board didn't start till grade 6. So suddenly I was doing math and French those years that we would have been transitioning from concrete to the more abstract stuff. And so I'm also curious, maybe was that related to it too? At the time that math was becoming different, I was also doing it in a second language. I don't know. I definitely feel that there were some other subjects that I missed some things because, again, I was just starting in the second language, and you know, you're studying higher level things, but your brain isn't completely thinking in the second language yet. So anyway, I do wonder if I missed some pieces there, but yeah, that kind of came up for me, and I want to give you both a chance, but I will maybe talk a little bit later about my thoughts just around, do I regret, like, let's say it was because of the French that I missed out on some of the math understanding. I've been thinking a little bit about, you know, would I trade that, or do I regret the French or the math? And short answer is no, but maybe I'll talk a little bit more about that later. I don't want to go on too long without giving one of you a chance, but I'd be interested to hear, you know, either of whoever would like to go, sort of what your thoughts are.
Well, I enjoyed maths at school, and I was, without sort of bragging about it, I was pretty good at it, and which was a problem because, yeah, I didn't mind the higher maths, and I don't know, I just enjoyed it. It was like a puzzle. If I had a quadratic equation, I used to love, I didn't care whether you could use it or not. That wasn't the point. It was, could I get the right answer? And there was only one answer. So I knew if I'd succeeded or not. And I used to like sitting there and working it all out and then getting the right answer. So I didn't really care whether you could use it. But this turned out to be a problem with my own children because they didn't like it. At maths, and they were always saying things like, why do we have to do this, Mom? We'll never use this, Mom. And I would think, but it doesn't really matter whether you're going to use it or not. Why don't you just enjoy it? And then I begin to wonder whether it was perhaps the problem was that the way, maybe if I presented the maths in a different way, they would enjoy it. Well, perhaps I was just presenting it to them in the wrong way. And it became my mission to try and get them to love maths as much as me by changing their experience of maths. And I think I succeeded to a certain extent, but I only have one child who actually did advanced maths. But yeah, I can't remember having any problems with it or not liking it or struggling. It was, in a way, very simple because you can write an essay or you can, or you have to learn facts, or my interpretation didn't have anything to do with the outcome. It was just right or wrong. And I liked that. But I was thinking about quadratic equations the other day, and I was looking for a video game to play, and I like the puzzle ones, and I think this is why, because I like working my way through the puzzles and getting the right answers so my avatar or whatever can progress to the next level. And just the shoot and kill ones don't interest me, but I like the puzzles. And I was actually thinking the other day, I couldn't find one I liked. Oh, well, perhaps I just go find myself some quadratic equations to solve. And then I thought, no, if you do that, Sue, you're that's crazy. I've actually forgotten how to do them. This is a thing also, we forget things we don't use. I just remember enjoying them. And I guess I could have sat down the other day and done some research and worked out how to do quadratic equations. But that's, I think it's difficult when you enjoy something and then I didn't have as much patience or understanding with my own children who maths wasn't the passion for them. They didn't have a natural inclination towards it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. Sue, I love the thought of you thinking of it as a puzzle and just kind of worth something in and of itself, right? Because I think whenever we talk about math, we always, it seems to me the conversation is always about you'll need it, or, you know, you'll use it, or this is good for developing your brain. But very rarely do you hear people talk about just purely enjoying it for its own sake and looking at it as a puzzle. And there's that, oh my goodness, I think it's called The Mathematician's Lament. Sue, are you familiar with it? It was from On Back, but that's when you're saying that, it makes me think about that. And it's written by a mathematician, and it's I wouldn't say it's a poem. I guess it's more of an essay. But he just talks about like the beauty of math and the wonder of math and how the way that we've broken math down and the way that it's taught. I'm going to get it wrong, but he's kind of making a metaphor maybe to something like art, where, you know, imagine if we were taking this beautiful thing, we all think of art as beautiful, and we were forcing kids and breaking it down for ourselves. And he sort of talks about it as this wondrous thing that we've lost sort of the understanding of the beauty of what it can be, that it was never meant to be this thing to kind of slog through. But anyway, I'll look for it and see if I can link it in the notes, but that's what it makes me think of when you're talking about just your pure enjoyment of it.
Yeah, you've got that right. And so I knew that my kids probably wouldn't need it. So that I came towards unschool maths in a different direction for most people, though we still had to prove for the homeschool records that my kids were learning particular skills. But it was that passion for it that I wanted to share with them, and not so much, oh, you'll need this, because I knew they wouldn't.
Hmm.
Yeah. Erin, I'm curious about that poem. I would really like to read it now, because I feel like that probably describes the experience of math that I'm trying to give my kids now. Is just, and especially I can see that with my daughter, just like, it, I guess the poem from what you've described makes me think about like patterns in nature and things like that. And just like math, how it can naturally, and numbers and patterns kind of evolve in our lives, and we can come across them, and it's more of a discovery than this thing that's imposed on us because, you know, like you said, quote unquote, we're gonna need it someday. You're gonna need this someday, so you have to learn it. And I think it's just approached in schools in just completely the wrong way. And just, it's uncomplicated, and we kind of make it like this scary thing that it doesn't need to be. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, my experience, like both of you, I think was pretty positive overall. But I also think that's because I just had a natural inclination toward how numbers worked, luckily. I don't remember a whole lot. Luckily, I do remember, I have like some, I have the positive memory, the really positive one, and the really negative one are sort of the two. And then the one that went from negative to positive, I have like these three standout math memories in my mind. So quickly, I will just explain what those are. So I tested into like a gifted program, I guess, when I was in elementary school. I think, you know, they give you this test in third grade. And so luckily that meant that I got this special class that I got to go to. It was probably only once a week during my elementary years, but it was all doing, you know, math puzzles and math challenges and stock market and just really getting to play with math in a sort of fun but challenging way. And so that was one of my like favorite memories actually of elementary school, was that class that was just something totally different and really fun. But then the downside of testing into that program was that when I got to the high school level, we had, and maybe it was the same thing for you, Erin, I think it was an Ontario thing, where there were three classes that you could be in for math, or three different levels. There was math, there was basic math, there was general math, and there was advanced math. And then there was this extra special class called enhanced math that, because I had tested into this program, I automatically went into that route. And I just remember being in that class and hating that class. It was math on a whole other level that I was not interested in at all. It was really complex equations. And I think it was, again, this idea that I was enjoying this fun puzzle, more abstract math. And as soon as it got into the advanced equations, it was like a different language that I was not at all interested in learning how to speak. So I actually dropped out of that class. And I remember the day that I did it being in a classroom where I was in this enhanced math class with all these kids who I felt were way, way smarter than me at math. They seemed to be really interested in that. And looking out the window at the other math class across the way, and the kids buzzing in and out of there with French fries from the cafeteria, and there was this like comfortable chaos that was happening in that room, and it was just like, this is not my speed. This room that I am in right now is, this is not where I want to be. And I just went down to the guidance counselor's office or wherever I had to go. And I was like, I just want to drop down a level because I think this is where I want to be over here. And so that was actually my last memory of high school math. I think I sort of took it as far as I needed to. And then, you know what, the other story I'll tell at another point. But it was more about algebra that I had to go into at university, and I hadn't done math in a long time. So, anyhow, that went. That's a story for another part of the conversation. But anyhow, it was. Yeah, it's interesting how we all have these things that we hold on to or try to forget about, or.
But it sounds like each of you had a sense of, I mean, I hear what you're saying, April, about that. I don't think we had enhanced math. I think we did have the basic general and advanced. It's possible we had it and I just didn't know about it.
You didn't need to.
I wasn't invited. Who knows? Maybe there was a special group in the, I don't know. I don't remember hearing about it, but I do think that it sounds like you both felt some degree of confidence like throughout the secondary school years. And I think I lost mine partly through that, or even maybe early on. And it's interesting when we struggle with something. Or I don't even know if I struggled with it. I felt I had a couple of teachers I felt quite nervous of, nothing to do really with math, just them. And so it's funny how different things get attached to experiences too. And so I don't think I had a huge hang up, but I definitely saw myself differently related to math than I had up until the time I was probably like 12 or 13. And then now, like as an adult, I started to realize how mathematically I do think. I mean, often we think people are thinking the same way we do. And I started to realize that, like when I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but if I'm driving somewhere or I'm walking somewhere or whatever, I'm always computing my rate of speed, and then I do all these things in my mind. I'm like, well, if I was to do this speed, then I'd get there by this time. And then I'd think, well, I wonder, I just spend a lot of time very naturally. These are things that just come into my mind every time I drive, every time. And they come to mind through my day too. I'm often thinking about what fraction of the day am I, like what fraction of my waking hours am I through? And I didn't realize that other people didn't think about this all the time until
Erin, I have
no.
never ever thought about that.
No, I
It's
would mention
fascinating
it.
to me.
Okay. I think about it with the seasons. Like I'm always like, oh, we're a third of the way through this season. Like, not that that's complicated, but it just is inherent for me to think that way. Right. So it's funny to think too, like this idea of who has a math brain and who doesn't. Like maybe math is such a broad thing. So maybe there's some parts of my brain that are very mathematical and other things that I'm just not really interested in. I feel like if you took any topic or subject, that's probably the case. People are, maybe drawn to one aspect of things. But it's interesting if you're not drawn to the aspect that's presented or valued, let's say in society or in school, you assume you're not that person, or you're not that like you don't have that skill. Yeah. Anyway, that was kind of a my own little tangent there. But just thinking about our kids. Sue, you've described a little bit about your kids' reaction to or not having the same exuberance that you'd had about some of the same things. I'm thinking when my kids were little, I think I've talked about this before, just how much I started noticing through play. And I know I've told this story, April. I think it might have been when we were talking. You were part of a Spot the Learning conversation, I think, with Kelly Edwards. And I was talking about one of the first things I noticed was my son setting up his big NASCAR mat with all his rows of cars. And it was really through pretend play that I heard him talking about the double digits of the cars, you know, the 88 car and the 45 car and so-and-so's in fourth position. No, wait, someone's passed them. Now they're in fifth. And he was quite young. I want to say 3, 4 maybe. And I thought, oh, you know, so you think about that, double digits, ordinal numbers, cardinal numbers, and it's all just coming in his, it's being expressed through the pretend play, but it's coming from playing with those cars, watching races with his dad. I mean, the order of things could be any number of things, us playing with different things over and talking about, you know, first, second, third, but he just put that together. And I picture, you know, some of the little workbooks that kids might have with, you know, teaching ordinal numbers or whatever. And it just, I think we get so nervous that it won't happen. But those are the experiences that I think have always interested me, where you just see it coming together during play. Mm-hmm.
Just everyday life. Like those workbooks you're talking about, Erin, I did buy a couple of those years ago, kindergarten and year one maybe. And they didn't even make sense, because they were trying to teach kids concepts like bigger than, smaller than, more than, less than, those sort of concepts. And I remember a page, and it had a picture of a house and a picture of a giraffe. And on the page, the giraffe was as big as the house, because that's the way the illustration, it wasn't to scale. And it said, what is bigger, a house or a giraffe? And I thought, well, the giraffe could be taller than the house if it's a short, you know, one-story house. But on the page, the giraffe looks bigger, but what's the right answer? Mm-hmm. And it was so easy to get the wrong answer, but still know what bigger than and smaller than is. But what child doesn't know that his dad is bigger than his friend's dad, or he's bigger than little brother, or that type of thing? They learn that pretty quickly. They pick up all that language and all those concepts just by living life, as you said, Erin, and watching racing, observing what's going on within the family. And you were saying ordinal, cardinal. You know, what child doesn't know if they're the youngest? What child doesn't know who's the eldest? What child doesn't know mum and dad are older than them? These concepts don't really need to be put into a workbook, and then kids have to just stick it all. You know, this is a multiple choice. This is bigger than that. It just seemed like a waste of time. And the only, I guess, value I could see in it is that if you've got all these workbooks with all the ticks in the right boxes, you can present those at homeschool registration time and prove that your child knows all these concepts. But it's just as easy to provide that evidence other ways. But that's the only reason I could see for doing that. It's, yeah, a waste of time.
Yeah. And isn't it so interesting as well that, like, to me, all of those types of assignments or worksheets or assessments, so many of them really rely on like a really clear question being asked. Like, it really depends on how the question is asked, like you said, Sue, on how the illustrations are presented. And also, for a lot of our kids, if they can't read yet, they're not going to know how to answer most of the math assessments on their own, because they're not even going to know what the question is. And so that's where I also feel like a lot of that stuff is just unfair, because if you have a child who has strong reading comprehension when they're young, they're most likely going to score higher on almost any assessment than a child that doesn't have that ability.
Mm-hmm. Well, the flip of that is a child with high reading comprehension might really start questioning those and saying, well, you know, exactly what Sue said, well, it depends, or You know, it feels like those questions need more clarification. Yeah, I often looked at those. It's funny. I had one child in particular who loved workbooks. And I think, especially those early ones, I think it's because they already knew, like, as you said, Sue, things like less than, more than, these are concepts that we're talking about. You don't, I mean, imagine figuring out whether a bowl is more full or more empty from a picture. Like, we just talk about that. So I think for them, it was sort of a fun, you know, they could just flip through with all their knowledge and check things off with their crayon or whatever. But yeah.
But if the child doesn't want to do it, there's no problem not making them do it. I think that was the point that I came to. Why do we have to fill this in? Well, you don't. You already know it.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Whereas I think for my guy, it was like, he was just having fun. He already knew what was being asked. So it was just fun to choose a color to do whatever with. But yeah, those, I mean, there are a lot of companies making a lot of money with those books, I think. You know, some of them are like everything you need to know by first grade or whatever. Mm-hmm. And they can be, I mean, if, as you said, Sue, if a kid is wanting to do them, they can be fun, but they're not, the odds that that's how a child is learning those concepts are slim, I think.
It's just like, I guess, having a puzzle book. They want to fill out the puzzle book, but it's not really a necessary help in learning early childhood maths, I don't think, because I feel that children, but though we do base our thoughts on our own experiences within our own families, and we all have families where we talk a lot and we put concepts into words. And I guess it's schools, and that you don't know the background of the child and what they might have missed out on. Mm-hmm. And maybe they don't watch motor racing. Maybe they don't have a little brother. Maybe somewhere along the line, they haven't had the opportunity to have conversations about anything with anyone. Mm-hmm. But in a family where you're interacting with each other and having conversations all the time, I don't think a child can help but pick up on all these basic maths concepts. You just think about things like, you were talking about fractions of your day, Erin. Well, we think about how we always give that example of, you can do fractions by cutting up the birthday cake or cutting up a pizza. But what child doesn't realize when they've got the smallest bit and it's not done equally, that the pieces, like a sixth of a cake is not, they didn't get a sixth of the cake if somebody else got a bigger bit than them. That's quite easy for them to see. And they're going to care about that. So, and maybe that's the point, isn't it? Things that kids care about or kids need, they're going to understand better than vague concepts like, is a giraffe taller than a house? Well, what child is ever going to see a giraffe next to a house? Mm-hmm. I mean, you go to the zoo and you'll see the giraffe next to their own house, which is not the same as our house. But then again, it is an interesting imaginative exercise to stand there and imagine an elephant and think, would it reach up to the whereabouts on our house would its head be? I'm not saying that there's no value in imagining situations which aren't real, because they're fun. But yeah, that example in that workbook was ridiculous. It could have been either answer, depending on, I think you were saying, April, it depends. It depends how tall the house is. They should have just done a mouse and a house. That would have been a better example. Yeah.
Yes.
But then again, if they had drawn the mouse big, the same size as the house, they were obviously hoping the child would realize in real life a mouse is smaller. But the child might have looked at that picture and said, well, normally a mouse is much smaller than a house. But in this picture, it is the same size or even a little bit bigger. Now, which answer do they want?
Yes. Well, and if you're, I mean, that can lead to fun. I could see that being a fun conversation, right? Like going through those workbooks and but not taking it too seriously. And there, that's the distinction between feeling like, you know, a company needs to put out this book so that kids can learn the difference between bigger and smaller versus just kind of using it as a fun, you know, just for fun and for enjoyment. But it makes me think too about, you know, how much we think about math, like those books. And then of course, even as you get older and they become more complex, those books are geared to getting kids to give the right answer. Is it this or is it this? Rather than I think what you were kind of talking about, April, is math as exploration, right? Like, where is it in nature? Where is it in our day? What are we, you know, kids playing with it, kids exploring it or discovering it in different ways. And we think of math as, and it's very much presented in those workbooks, you know, is it this or is it this? And I mean, I guess math is like that. It to a degree it is, but it becomes you solving somebody else's question that they've decided you need to answer rather than discovering it and exploring it on your own.
I was thinking about that, Erin, when you were talking about that magician's lament and the beauty of maths, and how I said that I liked the getting the right answer, and that's very much black and white. It's and I like that, but one of my daughters discovered what I described as more creative maths, that it can be black and white as far as, well, this is the right, this is all the right answers. Now just make sure you get them all. Or as April was saying about exploring maths and enjoying the discoveries and using maths in more creative ways. So I think it can be a creative subject like English, like you learn to spell and it's not, English comes alive, words come alive when you start using them creatively to make stories and not just, this is how you sound out a word. Now you know how to say the word and you can read this sentence you've got from the beginning to the end. But when you start using what you have gained or what you have learned as a creative tool. And I think maths can be used as well in a creative way. And maybe that's what I learned from exploring maths with my children and trying to find ways for them to enjoy maths, is that one child in particular, Sophie, she showed me the creative side of maths as so that it's not just black and white. It's a fascinating subject. So I suppose I started off wanting them to, my kids to enjoy the process of getting the right answer, and along the way, discovering that maths was much more than just working through your way through those quadratic equations and then having a big smile on your face and a sense of satisfaction and, wow, I love maths. It was a whole new world. And I gained a lot from not just doing maths the accepted way, not pushing my kids to do it, but to explore the subject with all of us in different ways. So, yeah, I'm going to have a look at that magician's lament as well, Erin. Thank you for that.
Yeah, no, you're welcome. I'm looking forward to digging it up because I think in there somewhere it talks about, maybe I feel like it does talk about this idea we have of math being that there's one answer and there's that we have this vision of it and that there are other ways to think of math. So yeah, you're welcome. I'm actually looking forward to looking it up myself and just kind of seeing what's in there.
April, maybe math is like the language of the world, whereas it's like a language, same as words of our own languages. They allow us to do things.
Yeah. And there's different ways. I mean, to go back to what we were talking about at the beginning, if we say maths, if we say mathematics, we're talking about, we're talking about the same thing and using different words. And I often think about that back to my fractioning, because the other thing I'll do that is I'll then put it into a percent. I really can't believe I'm admitting all this now. But this is how my brain works all day. So I'll think about like what fraction, and you know, it might even be if I'm driving somewhere, what fraction of the way am I so far? And then I'll think about what percent that is. And yeah, I do all kinds of conversions in my head. And so sometimes you can have the same thing, but there are different ways of expressing it, right? Or different ways of thinking about it. And I don't know, it's just so much more fun to think of it that way than this thing that you have to master that defines, you know, whether you're going to have the information that you supposedly need or not. I just feel like there's a lot of pressure put on the word math and the whole idea of it. But April, I wanted to ask you about, there had been a reel on Instagram, maybe more than one. I think you guys have like almost like a daily puzzle or something that you do, or maybe it's not daily, but
it may come across that way. It's sort of like a couple times a month, but
okay.
I think it happens that those, I'm always so fascinated about how those sort of evolve or what happens that I've got my phone out ready to record them. Cause it's just like,
yeah,
wow, that was not what I was expecting. Yeah.
Yeah. But that was, so your daughter was figuring out, was that a puzzle that you had set out, or was that something that you had found somewhere? Or
yes. So it was actually when we were coming back, we had a road trip to Canada. We normally drive to Canada in the summer to visit family. And this year when we were driving home, we were trying to find some like interesting ways to pass the time. So I think at one of our stops, I had looked up like 50 riddles or something like that. So we started doing these riddles in the car. And then when we got back in September, it was like, oh, you know, this might be a fun way to sort of start the day. We like to do things sometimes on whiteboards. So I think a couple of times I put a riddle on the board that, you know, they would try to solve. And then from the riddles, it sort of evolved into this like bigger sort of morning challenge, morning puzzle type of thing. And so I think the one you're talking about was just a couple weeks ago. Now, I want to preface it by saying, I think what made it so interesting to me was that because I was a teacher, but that sort of comes into play as well. It's like, I had spent all this time, right, doing, you know, math through school, like we all do, like hundreds of thousands of hours, maybe, of math as we're growing up. And then, you know, as I, you know, into adulthood started to think, I think when I had kids, I was thinking, well, when have I really, like, used the math that I learned in school? Well, I used it to teach math when I was an elementary school teacher for a short time. Outside of that, you know, do I actually write equations like ever on paper? Like, not very often. So I started thinking what is really important for my kids to know if they want to, you know, live a productive life and need to, you know numbers or whatever they're going to do with numbers. How are numbers going to come into play in their lives? Or if they want to do advanced math, what will they need to know? And for me, from the very beginning, it was just number sense. I just want them to understand numbers and how they come up in everyday life, whether, you know, it's grocery shopping or the speed of the car or the distance of the drive or in sports or, and it's, you know, you name it, like numbers are everywhere. So to me, I felt like putting numbers on paper, especially with equations and symbols and all of these things that probably wouldn't mean a lot to my kids when they were young, we just didn't do it. We still haven't done it. My son is 10, my daughter is 6 and a half, and we have done very little like pencil paper math almost all the math that we've done has been through conversation. So they have done a little bit of the reading eggs, math seeds, like online type stuff here and there. And they've done math. My daughter loves the Number Blocks YouTube channel. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but she is like such a song kid. That quick aside, she was so obsessed with these number block videos that she basically had all their times tables memorized when she was four through songs. So people thought she was like a math genius because they would ask her. She realized very early on that other people think math is really important. So she would have, you know, a conversation with other kids and they'd be like, "What do you mean you don't go to school? Wow. How do you learn anything if you don't go to school?" And then she would be able to rhyme off these times tables because she learned them from a song. Anyhow, so on this particular day when I was doing the morning challenge, it was an abstract problem where it was like basketball plus basketball equals 12. And basketball plus soccer ball plus football equals 17 or something like that. Sorry, can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it was like basketball plus soccer ball equals this. So what does football, basketball, baseball equal or whatever it was? So I assumed because she had not seen a lot of written math and that I would have to explain what she needed to do to solve the problem in order for her to solve it. So I had it written on the whiteboard. I went, and it had been there from the day before because we, you know, sort of, I had written it out and then we hadn't gotten to it. So I went to make coffee and, you know, I was probably took 3 or 4 minutes to do that. And then I came into the living room thinking that I was going to sit down, explain to her how to do it, and then we would work through it together. So, and I couldn't even remember what the answer was because, you know, it was something that I had pulled offline and hadn't even looked at it yet myself. So she said something like, "Mommy, you know, is the answer 23? And I was like, "I don't know. Let's take a look. How did you get 23? And that was when I was like, you know, I was so curious about what she was going to say. I started recording, having no idea that she actually had the right answer and she could explain how she got the whole thing to the point where I was like, okay, my husband must have told her how to do this before. And now she's just trying to impress me with how she can explain it. But truly, she had just figured out what to do on her own and, you know, had come up with the right answer. And what was more interesting to me after that was that kids who I know, like friends of my kids who are, you know, super smart kids would come in and they saw this thing and they were just like, "What is that?" But these are kids who had done a lot of math before but hadn't seen it kind of presented that way. And I think that sometimes to me, what that was saying was that sometimes once we get into that school way of seeing math, seeing it in a different way, almost is more challenging, like you don't know what to do with it until somebody kind of spells it out for you or explains what you're supposed to be doing. I don't know. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It does. And it makes me think about how, we think so we can talk. I mean, we can talk about how sometimes things are presented to kids before they're ready, you know, and kids kind of get pulled through without really having a conceptual understanding of things. And then the flip can be true as well, though, that sometimes at an age that's younger than we imagine, kids can grasp things that we assume maybe because it wasn't in the curriculum until, like, we don't remember it being in a curriculum until grade 7 or something like that. That because really, if I'm remembering, that was kind of like an algebraic process. She was solving for, I mean, that really was algebra.
Right.
She was solving for what was missing. Uh-huh. And so it's funny because I don't feel like that would be introduced to a 5 or 6 year old in the school.
Right.
I know it wouldn't be.
It wouldn't for sure. No,
but that was what she was doing. She was doing algebra without mm-hmm. realizing it was algebra. And it reminds me of, just to segue a tiny bit away from math, but I think it's the same idea. I remember when one of my sons, I remember him being 4, and it was New Year's Eve, and we were at like a community ice rink, and it was sort of like a public skating thing. And he was waiting for one of my other kids to come off the ice. And he looked down, and there was an area where the ice was kind of melty. Like, I just think so many people had been, you know, coming onto the ice from the entrance, and there was an arena worker there. Like, he said something like, he started talking about molecules and changes of state. And he started talking about how there was, you know, the ice was melting and there was this water and the molecules were moving further apart. And it was just this whole, and he just got into it. He was talking about, you know, atoms and all these things. And the arena worker looked alarmed almost and maybe almost irritated, like, what? And he said, how old is he? And I said, well, he's four. And he just looked astounded. But when you actually think about it, that is not, you know, that just came up in conversation, and we were talking about changes of state because it was winter. And so that comes up a lot as for us, as far as noticing when the, you know, we're going to put the defrost on, so the ice will melt on the windshield, all these kinds of things. Right. And so that to him was not a big deal to use those words, but I think, so that concept isn't really that hard, but no one's talking about that to a 4-year-old.
Right.
So it is surprising sometimes when you hear that kind of thing, come out. And then of course the reverse can be true. We can push kids into concepts that they're not ready for, or that are relevant to them. That was just very relevant to him that winter.
Mm-hmm. It's funny though, isn't it? It's like, it's so individual, because I think on one hand, like you said, we can completely underestimate them, because I think that they're capable of understanding so much more than we give them credit for at the beginning. If you just look at sort of like how the curriculum is laid out in school, in one sense. And then on the other hand, like you said, sometimes we're pushing these things on them so early or in such a complicated way when they're young. But I think it really just depends on the child, and trying to like have this approach that we think is going to work for all kids in all ways at the same time is just totally, mm-hmm. I think, unrealistic, but also unfair, like really unfair to the kids.
Yeah. Because it either puts them or holds them back. Sorry, go ahead, Sue.
Yeah.
No, I was just thinking that sometimes we get frustrated when our kids look like they've learnt concepts. I remember 2 of my children were on the tail end of online websites that had these interactive activities. So it was all fun music of colorful animations, and they'd work their way through it and get all the right answers, learn the concept, and then move on to the next one, and then not really have had an understanding of the concept enough. And so we look back and say, well, but you, like when they can't do something, say, but you learned that last week or the week before or last month, and don't you remember? And they say, no. And I think a lot of that's to do with just filling in the answers, get to the end of the activity so that you get the reward, and then you forget it, move on to the next one. But they have no grounding in need or relevance, like you were saying, Aaron. They haven't actually used those concepts or have seen a need for them. So they're not at the age, or maybe where it's come up naturally in their lives, or I always think that anything learned by experience, working it out for yourself, is so much more valuable than some concept that you're not really ready for. And though even if it's well explained, you're not going to retain it, especially with maths. My kids were racing through they're not workbooks, they were, I don't know what you call it now, racing through the activities to get on to the next level, like a game. And the faster they could go, the more rewards they could accumulate, the better they could get onto something new. But that was the reason they were doing it, is so that they could get the rewards, get onto the next level, not because they've picked up some concept which is useful or they could use or see in the real world. It's a concept that you learn to get to the end of their web page and get your reward. And then it has no value because you're onto something else. That was, I learned a lot through watching them do that before I thought, this is just a waste of time. Making, that was my compromise, was, we haven't really talked to Aaron, but maybe you were going to, about, should, like April was talking about ways to get number sense, but that's not sitting down and doing workbooks and drilling kids into their maths facts. And maths seems to be one of those subjects, well, the subject that a lot of people won't look at an alternate way of presenting to their kids. I unschool for every subject or everything in our lives, but not maths. And that goes back to what you were saying earlier. Was it Aaron, you were saying about the value of maths? Do we, or was it you, April, about we put maths on a pedestal? It was Peter Gray. Putting a maths on a pedestal, that we get so afraid that our kids won't learn the basic concepts, that we can't just let it go and let our kids experience it in their everyday lives with our help as well. Because I don't think wasn't enough for me. I wanted my kids to actually enjoy it and see the opportunities in the world, see where it's being used. And so I did a lot of math strewing to put my kids into contact with a lot of maths maybe that they wouldn't have known about, but not forced it on them, like strewing, you know, accept an invitation. Would you like to watch? Would we like to explore? Would you like this? Not interested? Okay, we'll put that to one side. But I was always looking for opportunities to present maths to my kids. But I'm going back to those web pages, those websites that have the interactive activities. Yeah, it took a while, but because I thought that was the answer to my problem of, oh, I hate maths, Mom. I don't want to do it. I thought, well, they'll love doing this because it's interactive, it's attractive. You get rewards. You can buy stuff in the shop, the virtual shop. You can build a little online world. And yeah, it did last a little while, but didn't last forever. And then it was back to, oh, do we have to do this, maths, Mom? And then I was thinking, well, if you're not even learning the concepts, what's the point? The only point I can see is I'm going to have a lot of maths records to show our authorized person at registration time. I'll say my kids did all this maths, and let's hope she doesn't ask if they still know it. How much did they retain? That was irrelevant. We had all the lovely records. And I thought, this is just wrong, because yeah, it gets us through our registration, but is that of value for my children? And like you, April, I wanted my kids to have a number sense and to enjoy maths and to be able to use maths in the world. But it wasn't enough that I had wonderful records and knew that my kids didn't know anything. So I had to find a new approach. And right. I guess that you sometimes in unschooling, you come to that, don't you, that you realize that pushing along traditional lines, maybe conventional ways of doing something, ticking off boxes, is just wasting our children's lives and our own. There must be a better way to spend our days together. That's not good enough.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you just figure it out, right? Like as you go along, you know in your gut that this is not right and this is not working. And you have to say to yourself, how do I make this work in a better way for my family, right? So that we're not feeling like we're wasting our time. And I think a couple of things that you brought up, Sue, are really important. I feel like I really connected with, I think it's all important, but I think a couple of the things that you said about them learning through their own experiences, right? Like you can't get better than that in terms of like that real world, real life, individualized context. Like without context, to me, if it doesn't matter to them, then it just doesn't matter at all because they're not going to remember it. So what's the point? And if, you know, we are lucky where we live that I don't have to keep that kind of those specific detailed records. So we're very fortunate that they say that we're supposed to have records, but nobody actually collects the records. It's very interesting. So I think because there's been so much gray area with that, and I realized that I didn't have to actually submit anything, and there's no detailed instructions of if we were to ask you to submit what that's supposed to look like, it really opened up my world in terms of me saying, well, if I don't have to submit this, then I'm not going to waste my own time writing all of this stuff down. So the way that I'm able to record keep is through Google Photos is how I do it. I'm just always taking pictures and making videos so that if I had to submit records, I would make a giant Google slideshow and send that to where it needed to go. And if they wanted to have an hour-long conversation of how all of that ties into, or a day-long conversation of how all that ties to each subject, you know, I would welcome that. But it's hard because, you know, as homeschooling parents, we only have so much time and energy. And it's like, if I'm putting all my energy into all of this detailed record keeping, what am I not doing? And so I was fortunate to figure that out early in the journey, not have to document in that way, but be able to document in the way that worked for me. And I feel like as unschoolers, we're very fortunate to have that option. But what it did as well is it just kind of opened up this opportunity to, you know, as we were saying, like really just be able to learn math in the context of our own lives and our own experiences. So math is one of those subjects, I think, like, you know, as we talked about in another episode, Aaron Science, where it just happens all the time. We just stumble into it all the time. We're talking about math all the time, but we almost never call it math. I don't Right. call it out as math. And I didn't even realize this until, you know, probably once I started talking more with you, Aaron, and just kind of all of this spot the learning stuff is that you start to hear it and you start to see it more often, right? Mm-hmm. My favorite example, you know, Sue, when you're talking about having something that's meaningful to them and they remember it was, I'm trying to remember which example you used, Aaron. I can't recall it this second, but for us, the fractions came about because we would take bike rides. And of course, kids are always like, when are we going to get there? How much longer? When are we going to be there? And it just sort of naturally evolved that this one route that we would take, it was almost equally divided into three parts where it's like once we get to the railroad tracks, we were a third of the way there. And when we got to the road where the cars came, that was two thirds. And then we would be there. So it was just this really easy conversation to have with them to say, you know, if we divide our ride into three parts. You know, once we get through that first part, that's one third, and then we're two thirds of the way there, and then we've got a third left. And we just sort of started talking about our ride in fractions. And then it's like, once they get that concept, you can apply that to so many other things in your life, right? Once they start to understand that when we're talking about fractions, all we're talking about are, you know, pieces of a whole, parts of a whole. It's like we transferred that to cooking and going to the pet store and, you know, money and their business and all these other things. And it just happens so naturally when you are not sitting and doing it on a piece of paper out of context.
Yes. Yeah. And that's so exciting to me, April, because you know, that's exactly what I do. So your kids are going to end up thinking the way that I do.
Oh, good.
Every time they're on a bike, oh, I'm a third of the way through. If we'd done the other route, I would. But that's exactly it. And it, you know, I think too, like the conventional way that we think of learning math is you have the information presented to you and then you can transfer it to real life. And, right. And that's the strategy behind it. Really, you will need this or you might need this. So we'll teach it to you academically or out of context.
And in the most complicated way possible. Yeah. And then
we'll teach it to you randomly in case you're in real life. Whereas when you're learning math naturally, you're learning it as you need it and as it comes up. And then I think that's why people find when, if they choose to pursue math or go further in math or do math in a formal way, it's the opposite. They're often able to do that more quickly because they have that learned math that's been in context with what they're doing. So it's literally a flip of, you know, it's just the opposite way of going about it. And it makes me think about, and I don't know exactly what I meant. When I had emailed you about just some thoughts about things to talk about, and I was talking about the words embodied math came up to me, and I'm not sure if I have read them somewhere. I did search it and it does come up on the internet, but I don't think they were resources that I had read. But what I had meant by that is just this inherent math that we have even within our own systems, so our own bodies. So thinking about, you know, music and how natural it is for some more than others, but to keep beat, right? To keep beat and to understand rhythm. And so that's the type of thing to me where it's like, I imagine music existed, people were making music. And so at some point that became transferred to notations and timing and all those sorts of things within music theory. But the theory didn't come first. You didn't create music theory or write down a bunch of music theory and then somebody decided to create music. Music is something that is within us as people. And so the theory is an expression of what we already know inherently. And I got thinking about that with so many different things. You know, if I was watching my kids play different sports, especially ones that had some physics involved, like skateboarding or snowboarding, where they're working with speed and they're working with different angles. And they don't need to sit down and write that all out to do it. You know, that's they know that inherently they can,
absolutely, you
know, but if they come at this at a slightly different angle, or if they pick up their speed here or decrease their speed here, they know they're going to have the outcome that they want. And so I guess the question is, how necessary is it to be able to write down the theoretical part behind that? And I mean, I'd be interested to hear what you both think. And to me, it's useful if it's useful. Like, that's how I would answer that question. It's as useful as it is to the person. And I think the argument that sometimes comes up is people will say things like, well, they might need it for this, or they might need it for that. And I think my answer to that would be, well, then they will learn it. And they may already know it. That's the thing. Like, that's my curiosity is when we have this kind of like embodied math or embodied anything, how much easier is it for us to do that in a formal way? And, you know, my feeling is it's much easier. And I think there have been studies that suggest that it's easier, but I don't know. I just think about all the things that we think we're going to use this math for, but we're doing those things anyway.
Right.
I mean, even my example of me driving and figuring out rates of speed and all those sorts of things, I mean, that's fun for me to do. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure the person beside me on the highway isn't doing that. And they still get to where they need to go.
Right. Yeah. And that's what's so interesting to me that you use like music as an example, because, you know, some people for sure like to learn the theory or how to read the notes or all of those things first. And then there are other musicians, as we know, that just, they learn to play by ear. Mm-hmm. They play music their whole lives and they can't read music at all.
Yeah.
So it really is fascinating to just kind of turn a lot of these things, you know, on their heads and say, but what if this, but what if that? And I'm with you, Aaron. I really feel like, especially nowadays, anything that we want to learn, we can learn it when we want to know. Not only can we learn it, we can take a class, we can watch a video, we can find someone to teach us. Like there, and that's how it is for our kids. And that's why, you know, this whole idea of like gaps in learning or falling behind or whatever it is that people, you know, get so worked up about right now, it's like we don't need to worry about that, because when our kids want to know something or when they need to know something, they can learn it, right? It's just, I don't even understand how we're all still so concerned about that.
I know. Well, and I think sometimes people have concerns about not, like, let's say that their child wanted to do something and they suddenly needed a certain level of math that they hadn't done formally. And I guess for me, it's a couple of things. Like we're already saying, I think they will pick up that formal math more quickly because they have the inherent lived experience of it. Mm-hmm. But I also think that when we're talking about learning naturally, or we're talking about unschooling or self-directed learning, we're not talking about keeping that information away from them.
Right.
Not like we have many, many math resources in our house, from things you would find naturally to we have like an encyclopedia of maths. We have workbooks. We have various things. You know, we have math tools, all kinds of things. Nobody, I don't think anybody's talking about not, Sue, you were talking about strewing some interesting things, and it's not keeping mathematical learning from our children. It's just engaging in it in a way that's in context for them and that they're interested in and willing to do. And I think that what I found as my kids got into sort of the older teenage years is that they inherently, if they had a goal that they wanted to meet, whether it was applying somewhere or learning a skill or whatever, they were inherently finding out, or sometimes we would partner with it, but really they were very good at figuring out what was it that they needed to meet that goal. And so I think the concern is sometimes, well, kids need to do things that, you know, not everything in life is going to be something that you enjoy, and will they have the discipline to do a course or a credit or whatever. And my experience is that yes, they do. And that's the experience that I have with lots of other people that I know as well. Whereas I found that sometimes when I have known kids or done some work with kids who have had many, many years of school, it's actually very hard for them to self-direct their higher learning. It's hard for them to, and I'm speaking generally, for some kids, it's not hard. I don't mean to paint everybody with the same brush, but I do certainly know of some kids where it's really hard for them to go back and do a step that they need to do something else. And I honestly think they're burnt out. It's really different to have had so many years of being told what to do versus coming at something from a self-directed perspective and saying, oh, you know, I might need this English credit, or I might need this mathematical learning or whatever, mm-hmm. if I want to pursue this. It's so different. It's so different when you come to that, even if you don't like it, like even if you're still kind of slogging through the work, it's mm-hmm. different if it's your goal that you're meeting. And Sue, I'm sure that you can relate to some of this from your experience as well, that it's just different, isn't it, when kids are setting their own goals?
It is. I have one child who did advanced maths, and that was Imogen. She decided that, well, she wondered whether she wanted to apply for medicine at the university, and she looked at the prerequisites, and one of them was math. So she said, "Mom, I'm going to do an advanced maths course because I'll need it if I decide to go ahead with medicine." So I said, "Okay, then." And we found an online maths program, which was okay, but she got stuck at a few concepts, and I had lots of other children that I had to spend time with, and she wasn't getting enough of my one-on-one time with it. So I said to her, "Well, how about we find you a math tutor to help you?" And she said, "Yeah, that sounds good." And it really worked out well, because we found out that one of our older parishioners, a friend, he was a maths and a chemistry tutor. And I asked him if he could tutor Imogen in maths, and he was delighted. He didn't charge her anything. He just wanted to do it because out of pure love. He wanted to spend time with her, share his passion. And she had some fabulous sessions with him over the course of a year, I think. And she really enjoyed it, the whole experience. And she completed the course. She did really well. And then she decided she didn't want to do medicine after all. She was going to go do writing. Then what is interesting is the satisfaction she got out of doing it. She was the first Elvis child who had done advanced maths. And when you have lots of brothers and sisters, there's not a lot, and you're fourth in line, there's not a lot left to do. It turned out, Gemma Rose is the youngest, she had to it was even more difficult for her to find something that she could be the first person doing, but they all wanted to be the first person within the family to do something. So this gave Imogen a real sense of satisfaction. I'm the first Elvis child to have done advanced maths. Then we talked about this several years down the track. I was writing maybe something about maths, and I quite often in the old days when my kids were around, I'd ask their opinion about something or get a quote from them. And we started talking about how much maths she remembered from that advanced maths course. And she said, "Mom, I don't remember much of it." She said, "I didn't need it. I didn't do the medicine. I didn't need the math. And because I didn't need it, I let it go. It was fun to do at the time because I felt I was working towards a goal, but then I didn't need it." So she said she just let it go. But she said, I think it was, we were talking about music at the same time. And she said, that's what another example was. She did a lot of music knowledge lessons, all the information behind particular pieces of music. And she said it was exactly the same, that once she had taken those music knowledge exams, she just let all that information go because it didn't interest her. What interested her was playing the piano. And she said, "Mom, I'll never forget how to play the piano because that's the bit that I love. Everything else I had to do." She had to do the music knowledge in order to pass her piano lessons. It was part her practical. It was part of the practical. But she just confirmed what I already knew, that if you don't use knowledge, if you have no use for it, you're more likely to forget it. And you're more likely to learn it if you do have a need. And even things that that you learn formally, like I'm doing a maths course, you can learn it if you have a need, and that need might be, I want to get into university, and that can be enough motivation to learn it. But if you don't learn, if you don't have a need for it later on, you're more likely just to forget it. So in her case, it wasn't a waste of time. She got the satisfaction from doing it. She did think at one point she might do medicine. And she did enjoy it because she had a good tutor who made it interesting and shared his love for the subject with her. So it wasn't difficult and something she couldn't understand. It was something that she looked forward to doing every week.
I have so many things that have popped into my head. The last couple of things we've been talking about, I'm trying to think about what to say first. So I guess on that topic of that older sort of older kid, Sue, and you know, Imogen choosing to do that and go through that process. April, you were I wonder if this might be a time to circle back. You were talking about your experience. I think you were going to talk about your experience with algebra in college or in university.
Are you reading my mind right now?
No, I just.
I mean, okay, so literally for the last 6 minutes since you spoke and then Sue spoke, I was like, wow, that really is exactly what happened to me. And then I was like, should I tell that story? Yeah, I'm going to tell that story. No, I won't tell it. Yes, I will. And now I'm watching you and I'm like, has she just been watching my brain go through
no.
conversation? That's so funny, Erin. But that, yes. So I will briefly interject with that if that makes sense. Because, you know, although my kids are young, so I have no stories that I can tell about them as older self-directed children, that was in fact my own experience, which I didn't realize until you were talking earlier. And so with your story is basically that was what had happened to me was I basically stopped taking math classes. Probably I took whatever I needed to in high school, but I was not enjoying it. I got to university and there was one math class that I needed to take. And this is like one of my standout memories from however many years ago that was, many years ago. I remember that I had to take it as a night class. So it was a math class. It was a night class. And I think it was the second or third class. I was sitting in the lecture hall, and algebra to me at that time, I might as well have been learning Japanese. Like I was so stressed out. I was so overwhelmed. And I remember walking out of the class, going, get this, to the payphone. This is how long ago it was. Went to the payphone, put the quarter in, called my dad, and I said, I hope that this is okay with you. But I'm taking a math class right now and I need to drop the class. Like, I just can't do this right now. It was just not working. And fortunately, he was like, that's okay. I understand, whatever. And I remember hanging up the phone. Like, I can feel it right now, hanging up the phone and just having this tremendous sense of relief that it was like, thank goodness I never, ever have to go back into that class. And I knew that I was going to need to take it to graduate, but I couldn't do it in that moment. And then it was so interesting that it was probably 3 years later that I had to eventually do it in order to graduate. And it was a breeze. It was a breeze. I aced it. Like, I just can't even believe that it was the same class. But like to your point earlier, it was my choice when I was taking it. It was my choice that if I wanted to graduate, this is what I had to do. It was probably maturity. It was like a lot of different factors. But the point was like, it wasn't that I couldn't do it back then. It was that I didn't want to. And just the simple fact that I wanted to do it that time changed the entire experience. And I think that's the cool thing, is that if you can hold on to that, I think, you know, speaking for me right now and anyone who is in my position with young children at this moment, it's like, it is so easy to be afraid and not trust and get overwhelmed and feel like you're going to get blamed and you're doing everything wrong, when you think like, but what if my child wants to do this and they can't, or I've prevented them somehow, or I've, like, you feel like it's all going to be on you, that you are going to be, you're failing as the parent if they can't get this thing that they want. But the thing that's very hard for us to see when we have the little ones is not remembering that maturity and, you know, is such a big factor in all of this. It's like, no, he doesn't want to do the math right now because he's a 9-year-old boy and it means nothing to him. But that doesn't mean that when he's, you know, 19 or whatever age, that he's still going to be that same kid that doesn't want to do it. Everything is going to change between then and now. And once any of us decide that we want to do something as human beings, you know, if you want it, you can figure out how to do it, especially now with all the resources that are out there.
I feel like that's a very powerful story, April, just because, yeah, it was the same course. And I think it's entirely possible that it's just even that extra 2 or 3 years that, you know, your brain was in a different place. But I feel like the fact that there was choice involved is probably huge, because I think our emotions, how we learn is so tied to our emotional state, our stress levels. And I think that maybe speaks to why, when I was nervous around those, especially my first high school math teacher, and there, you just almost clamp up emotionally, or at least I did. And it's very hard to learn when you're feeling watched or anxious or judged.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I can almost feel that adrenaline, like, you know, thinking back to that and imagining that moment where you decide to make that phone call. And sometimes you just know, it sounds like you were just like, this isn't going to happen for me right now. Mm-hmm. I think that's such an interesting, emotional piece of that is such an interesting thing to think about. And I think, like, I'm in a place right now where, so some of my kids, as I mentioned, they, got senior credits to be prerequisites for something else. And I have a child right now who, well, he's not a child, he's an adult, who decided not to do that, who opted not to do that, even though I know that his actual knowledge and skill was easily comparable to, because I saw what the credits look like through my other kids, I knew that it would not be a problem. And in fact, maybe the least problem for him, ironically, but, you know, like you're saying, it just wasn't something that was interesting to him at the time. And he's trying to make some decisions right now, whether to stay with what he's doing, maybe whether to try something new. If he tries the something new, he will probably need those credits. So we were just having a conversation last night about that, and just kind of exploring different pathways to, if he does decide to go that route, to get those credits. And then by the end of the conversation, I'm not even sure he's even going in that direction. But the point is, I didn't feel any blame from him. He knew the option was available, because it was to the others. So, you know, it's not like I stopped him from pursuing that. That was very much his decision, that he didn't want to do those in a provincial way. So I do wonder sometimes if parents, if there's that responsibility of, is my kid going to get to a certain place and say, oh, you didn't, you know, you didn't push me to do this, or you didn't require me to do this. And so now I don't have this accreditation, or maybe some people are thinking I don't have this skill or whatever. And I just find that when we draw it back to respect and relationship and connection with our kids, that they know the intention is there to offer them what's going to work best for them, what they need. I didn't, because the thought crossed my mind as I was sitting there, you know, we were sitting together last night thinking this through, and the thought did cross my mind. I thought, should I have nudged things forward? You know, would things be smoother now if I had nudged that forward? And so I think here's the thing. In some ways they would be. In some ways they would be smoother, because he would have, I think it's just two, it's an English and a math that he would need, right? He would have those done. And so that would be a step that he wouldn't need to do. So there's some truth on a practical level that perhaps that would have been smoother. But what is the trade-off? And the trade-off would have been in the relationship, because he was clear he didn't want to do it. And he was 17 or 18 years old. So what am I doing at that point? I'm right. Right. Mm-hmm. But even if he'd been younger. And so I just feel like sometimes it is true that there are times that things might move more efficiently or move at a faster pace if we push things or require them. But the risk is always that that can completely backfire as well. And it can backfire in a couple of ways. It can backfire with relationship, and it can backfire with actually acquiring the skills. As I've kind of described with my high school experience, that when we're feeling pushed, we really don't learn very well.
Right.
So I suspect now if he was to take those credits, he would fly through them, just because I know the amount of math and language he's even using in his work. It's like he's gone, the practical stuff he's using is actually higher in some ways. But yeah, it just, there's a trade-off there, isn't there?
Yeah.
Push.
Yeah. But also, what if kids did blame us for anything that we've given them as parents? That is almost... that's on them, not to look at themselves as, I'm a victim of the situation here. I don't think that, I haven't had that experience, but I was talking to Cecilia Conrad during one of our discussions, and she would say that if a child came back, not a child, it would, you know, be, our children are young adults by that stage, come back and say, oh, mom, you should have made me do this. You should have made me do that. You didn't give me this. You didn't give me that. And she says something about, well, just suck it up. What are you going to do about it? You can't blame your parents we've partnered with our kids all the way through. And then to turn around and change your mind that's what you wanted as a child. No, I didn't want to do this maths course. I didn't want to do that. And then come back and say, you should have made me do it. First of all, as you said, Erin, they wouldn't have done a very good job being pushed anyway. But also like being a victim and taking responsibility for yourself. That's one thing we can give to our kids, is that we're talking about things as they're growing up. Well, this is the option. This is what would you like to do? This is my experience. How do you feel about it? You don't want to do it? Well, you know that if you don't do this, well, maybe you'll need to do it later, or it's not relevant now. I see a lot online about kids who come back and blame their parents for their poor upbringing and their poor education as far as homeschoolers go. And I think that is so sad, when all we're doing is trying to bring our kids up the best way we can. And whose responsibility is it?
Mm-hmm. And
we have to assume responsibility. And as our children are growing up, they're gaining more and more responsibility along the way for their own lives, so that hopefully when they come out the other end, they are ready to go and not be a victim and blame other people for things that might not happen or mistakes they make, but to take it upon themselves. Well, this is where I am, and I need this to do whatever I want to do. Now, how am I going to do it? Not, Mom, you should have made me do this 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. It's like an attitude.
Yes, totally. Can I just interject for 1 second? I just want to clarify when I said blame earlier, and I can only speak for myself, not for other parents of young kids. But I think I was thinking less about my kids blaming me and more about me blaming myself.
Yes. Right.
Feeling I should have figured this out sooner so I could have guided you in a better way, sort of thing, maybe. I think it could go both ways, though. I definitely hear what you're saying, and I see those conversations online as well with kids blaming their parents. But I think also the parents can blame themselves. Or I guess I don't want to get to a point where I'm feeling like I would blame myself for something. I think that's part of the fear of trying to guide them in a way down a path that I haven't been down myself, maybe, is the idea.
But then, April, you were talking also about we can learn anything at any time. Mm-hmm. So that even if we do make mistakes as parents and think, well, I should have done this, I should have done that, or I wish I had, it's still not too late. Right. That hopefully we've given our kids the vision, the responsibility, the resources, whatever, for them to go out there and say, well, I didn't have that, but I can do it. They've got the confidence maybe to go out and think, well, it's not all over because I didn't get that advanced math certificate by the time I was 18. But as you were saying, Erin, it's a real trade-off, isn't it? That if you... I just remember years ago, it was around about the same time I had that conversation on Facebook about the maths and the math. Might have been the same person, actually. I was talking about learning times tables and how my youngest wasn't interested in all these games that you learn to do your times tables. You know, the ones where you sit there and they look really cool games and you've got to work out what 6 times 6 equals before the balloon falls to the ground or whatever. And
the finger tricks.
Yeah, and it brings in also what you were saying about stress and how you don't learn very well, that you freeze, your brain freezes because you know you've got 20 seconds or something to get the right answer. And if you don't get the right answer, this voice is going to come up and say, wrong, you failed. And you think, wow, what a message is that they're sending our kids? And so we stopped doing that. But she didn't know her times tables. She couldn't say 6 times 6 is 36, 6 times 7 is 42. But she knew them because she would sit down and I don't know how she did it. She worked it all out. But anyway, I was sharing this about how she couldn't recite her times tables. And the person that was involved in the conversation said, well, just sit her down, make her learn it. And I thought, well, maybe my life will be easier if I did that, if she knew them all by rote, because then if she was ever asked, the answer would fly off her tongue, and I will have done my duty by instilling that basic maths fact in her. But at what cost? What was the trade-off? The trade-off, I think you're saying, Erin, is the trust, the connection. You break the bonds over maths and times tables. You break the bonds over everything. It flows out. Your kids can't trust you there, that situation. How will they trust you in a different one? And it seemed like a very small thing. Just sit down, learn those facts. And I thought, no, it will have a flow over effect. This, it's the principle behind the thing. And I wasn't willing to break that trust so that I could tell everybody, oh, my daughter, she knows her facts. This is the way she learnt them. Yep, tick that off. We're moving on. And what I feel, that's one of your discussion questions I was looking at, Erin, earlier. I haven't got them in front of me, but I was thinking about how kids learn things regardless in their own way. So just because they haven't learned something in the traditional, conventional way, the way that's easily tested, the way that you can immediately see, doesn't mean they haven't learned it. And I think, as you were saying about your days, Erin, with I'm third of the way through my day, I'm the sixth of the way through my day, whatever. And you were talking about your journeys. If you go this fast, you'll arrive so many minutes earlier. And how far are you going? And we used to do the same thing with running. If I want to run 5K and I want to beat my last time, how fast will I have to go? And how much did I improve my time? What percentage did I improve it by? I have run 4.75 kilometers. How far do I have to run to get to 5? And these are all things we knew as we were running along. It wasn't just standing there with our fingers, you know, trying to calculate it as we're running along. We knew it because it was our thing. But in doing that, I realized, well, if I set a math problem with 2.65 plus 10.73, what's the answer? And you sit there and think, well, she can't do that. But she was quite capable of working it out when we are running. And what fascinates me about maths is there's more than one way of learning how to do something. And the value, I think, is not in memorizing the way that everybody else is learning, because even that changes. You hear about school curriculums deciding to teach division in a different way because it's not working, and we'll try this way. But when a child is immersed in their own life and have problems to solve, they'll work out the answer in their own way. And I might not be able to see it from the outside, the processes that are going on inside. But so many times that has happened, and I have thought, you didn't need me to give you the formula or to give you the additional information. You worked it out because you just sat there and thought about it and what the needs were. And I really don't understand a lot of the mental processes that go on in our children's heads. I'm sure people don't understand what goes on in my head sometimes, but it is interesting. And kids are able, we're back, I think, to what you were saying, April, about kids are capable sometimes of doing things we just don't give them credit for. We think because we didn't teach it to them, they mustn't know how to do something, but they work it out themselves. And maybe a child's way of learning to do something is more valuable than the accepted way because it belongs to them. And it's not as if they forget how to do it, they won't forget how to do it. They might forget the formula, but they won't forget how to do it because they've worked it out for themselves. And it might not happen as quick off their tongue, like 6 times 6 is 36, but they'll understand what they're looking for and what they're trying to work out, and they'll understand the value of it. And I don't think there's any reason to worry about kids who don't do the formal maths, because I've had a couple like that, and they've come out maths capable. Mm-hmm. And not only maths capable, but one of them is actually maths creative, and they love maths. And I remember one of my daughters said to me, she was just after some maths experience, I don't know what it was, I can't remember, it was in a blog post somewhere, and she said, oh, her eyes were just so lit up with joy. And she said, Mom, do you think I could become a mathematician? And I thought, if you want, of course you can. She never did. But it was that feeling at that particular time that she felt so in love with what she was doing and in so control and in command of the subject that she felt, oh, I could do this as a job. This is, I love this. And who knows, down the track, she may have a job that needs those types of math skills. But she never did advanced math, but she still loves math. And she can still do all her problems and work out her life. Yeah, it's very interesting. And I think a lot of what we're saying, the problem isn't our children, it's us. Can we trust our kids? Are we worried about what other people will think if our kids don't have maths records, like can't say their times tables straight off their tongues, or don't have any conventional maths records to present to somebody at registration time, or somebody for a, we don't have this system here, but I'm writing up, what is that piece of paper or that document called that you have to write for your children before they go to college?
Oh, like a transcript.
That's right. Yeah. And what am I going to write on the transcript? That type of thing. But I also have found it is quite possible, if you're willing to put the work in, to come up with alternate records for maths that will satisfy educational departments. If you're willing to be observant and to take time to write things down about what kids we observe our kids doing and the conversations we have, and if we're willing to translate that all into conventional maths language, it is quite possible to reassure a conventional, traditional education department that our kids have math skills. Mm-hmm. And in so doing, I suppose, it also reassures us that we really don't have to force it into them. They're learning it as part of their lives.
Mm-hmm. That's, creative problem solving at its best, right, Sue? I feel like that's kind of where all this is leading to me, like just listening, thinking about this conversation and listening to what you just said. It's like, we all talk about all these big problems that we have in the world that need to be solved. And it's like, how are we going to solve them all if we are all being taught to think in the same way? And that's kind of what gives me hope from this conversation, is that if we're letting our kids solve these problems in different ways, in their own ways, in unique ways, they're the ones that are going to be coming up with unique, creative ways to solve the big problems that are out there, right? If you have a whole group of kids and most of them have learned math in the same way, they're likely going to get to the same answer, in my opinion, or some form of that same answer. But if you've got these totally outside the box thinking kind of kids, you know, that's what the world is going to need. And it's kind of exciting to just, rather than give them an equation and have them solve it, it's like, let's give them like the problem, or let them run into the problem and just see all the different ways that they can attack that or approach that, and what they come up with. Because I feel like, you know, what we were saying before about really underestimating them, it's like, what I find as an unschooling parent is just that my kids are always surprising me. And I think that's one of the best parts. It's like, yes, you want to know, yes, you want them to be able to figure things out. But when this thing comes up and you're just like, wow, you know, I've been looking at this same situation my whole life, and I have never thought about that before, or I would never have approached it that way. And I think it's because for me, I recognize that sort of conditioning around these things. You know, it's like, oh, I only would have ever thought about this in that way because that's how I was taught to do it. Whereas you've been presented with this situation and nobody told you what to do. So you came at it from this completely different direction. And to me, that's always what is most fascinating with this process. Just like you said, Sue, it's like, it's really getting ourselves to think about it in a different way, right? To like recognize that the math learning is happening, even though it's not pencil paper learning. It takes seeing it differently as a parent and being able to say, you know, I might, if I gave my child this written, you know, pencil paper math test, they probably couldn't answer any of the questions. And I'm okay with that because I see my child learning math in all different ways every day. And I think that long term, that is what is going to serve my child. But there's a huge, you have to feel confident as a parent, I think, in order to get to that space where you're like, if someone quizzed my child or gave them this piece of paper or this assessment, they probably won't do well on it. And that's okay. But I think it takes a lot to get there.
Yep, I actually tried that, April, because my husband's a primary school teacher. They're at schools. They have these maths and English tests that they do particular years. They're not every year, but they're called NAP plan tests. And all the students have to do them. And then the results get sent. It's not an internal school thing. It gets sent to the education department. And I think their schools are actually ranked on it. So this school had good marks for the NAP plan test. This school is a better school than this school. Everything exactly is.
Too.
Yeah. But because he had these tests, both my youngest daughters were in primary school at the time and they were of the right age. I think they do them every 2 years. I'm not sure. They were at the right age anyway for the test. And I had one of my big stupid ideas. I thought, well, if he brings the tests home and they do the tests and pass the tests for their age and pass, I can go to the homeschool records people and say, look, my girls have maths appropriate for their ages. And that would just say it all. I wouldn't have to worry about any complicated records. Now, as I said, it was a stupid idea. They sat down and
I don't think it was a stupid idea, actually. I'm very curious to see how this played out. But I mean, I can imagine now, but I don't think, just for the record, that it was a terrible idea.
Well, I didn't have to force them to do it. They were both interested. Oh, we'll do something from school. This might be interesting. So they sat down with their bits of paper and their pencils. And then I started timing it and all this. And before long, the smiles on their faces disappeared. And what I realized was my kids had no experience of doing tests. Now, if they'd been in school, they would have been,
coached.
But the weeks before the test, all the teachers would have gone over all the work. They would have been, what's that word?
Reviewed.
My words. Huh?
Is it reviewed, Sue?
Yes, that's the word. They would have reviewed it. They would have done it a million ways because the teachers wanted the kids to pass. They would have been fresh on their minds and they maybe would have given.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I'm sorry. The teachers would have actually taught to the test.
Exactly. They would have given examples. They would have told the kids what to expect. What I did was I just whipped the test out, put it in front of them. Here's a pencil. Go sit down and do it. Right. Then Sophie got it. They both did pass. And Sophie got quite a high mark. I can't remember exactly. It's on my blog somewhere. I would have guessed around about the 80% mark. Gemma Rose passed too. But doing it was just so, it was such a trauma for them both. But what the worst thing was, when I marked it and I said, well, that's right, that's right, that's right, that's wrong. All right, you've got 80%. And then they'd never had been marked like that before. And Sophie said, but I could try that one again. And she She is used to doing things until she gets the right answer. She has never been told that you only get one chance of getting this right. And it's too late now, Sophie. The test is over. You got 80%. You didn't get that 20%. But Mum, could I have another go? No, this is your answer. I had two girls in tears and I thought, this is silly. The test didn't prove anything. It proved that I hadn't taught them how to take tests. That's all it proved. They knew their maths. And it got us so upset about everything. I had two upset girls. I said, I'll never, ever do that again.
Okay, so I have, so now, Sue, that's, I was just thinking that we need to wind up soon probably, but now there's another added, what I was going to say is I have a few things I think we're going to need to have another episode on math, which, because now I have more thoughts too around mastery and I have a lot of thoughts about a whole bunch of things now, but the last two things that you've each said. And then I have examples coming to mind about how my older kids have, I just have thoughts about test taking and the ways that they've gone about things. So I feel like maybe I feel like there's enough new stuff that maybe we should think about another episode. And I don't mean to, you know, whether both of you or either of you is available or not, Ashley and Haley might be as well, but I think it would be fun if you were available and we could continue talking about math, because now I'm thinking that there's actually so many different pieces to this. I would love to talk about, and Sue, you made reference to it and it kind of sparked a thought in me about, I want to use the word like gamification or strewing math, but thinking about what are our motives and how does that come across to our kids? I would be interested in talking more about record keeping as well for people who are in places where they have to do record keeping or even testing. Because I've been interested in some things you've said in the past about that as well, Sue, around, because you're in an area that has to record keep. And I still think it would be fun to talk more about, so if we're not requiring math, if we're not requiring certain things, what are we doing? How do our kids go about learning things? And I think we touched on it a lot as far as how much conversation we're having with our kids. But yeah, I would love to dive into all that a little bit more as well.
Maybe talk about identifying the maths in our everyday lives that we pass over.
Yeah.
Because I think parents don't often see the maths, and that's why I've written some in-depth articles on particular things like cooking. We just think cooking, that's fractions, and we don't see the million other maths principles that our kids are using while we're in the kitchen.
Yes. Yeah. The kitchen is often, cooking is often thrown out there, but I think it's not looked very deeply at sometimes. It's just,
no.
Yeah.
The kids, it's so complicated as maths, but yeah, you think, all right, fractions, what now? Weighing, what now? And there's, and such rich experiences in things like cooking and gardening and all sorts of other things that our kids are just so immersed in numbers. Well, it's not just numbers, is it? Because maybe maths language, we tend to think of maths as numbers, but it's not. It's what we started off with less than, more than, estimating stuff. There's more to maths than numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
I think,
absolutely. Yeah.
In the context of entrepreneurship as well, or having our kids run little businesses and things like that, we've had a lot of experience there that has just given like really rich context
to
all kinds of math as well.
Yeah. Okay. We definitely have another
episode. And one more thing, Erin.
Yeah.
There's one more thing we didn't talk about, which you proposed, and I thought was interesting was that a lot of people say we should make our kids do maths to increase their mental capacities, their brain power, and we didn't talk about that. That would be interesting as well.
Yes, yes, exactly. Okay, so we have, I feel like our list is growing, but it will be good. I think it will be good because I do think it's like anything, right? We're talking about a topic, but it branches into so many different things. And I just wanted to circle back to something before we finish. And I also just wanted to say that when we were talking about the relationship end of things and that can be the drawback, that is a drawback to pushing and sometimes even nudging a little too much. But I also just wanted to say that math, I think, is like anything, whether that's reading, whether that's learning to ride a bike, whether it's learning to swim, any of those things, where there's something about not taking away the opportunity for kids to come into things in their own time. Because I'm sure we've all had the experience that when we see kids read or, you know, get excited about figuring out a mathematical concept or decide that they're really ready to ride their bike or whatever, it is so different from when we're pulling them along. It is like night and day. And I'm not sure that many people realize that, because our culture is so like, get them in swimming lessons at this age. Are they riding a bike yet? Are they toilet trained yet? Can they read? And they're, is it the end of the world to, no, you know, there's lots of things where maybe we encourage or whatever, but what a difference when kids come to things on their own. And that doesn't mean that we don't facilitate things, that we don't offer opportunities, that we don't narrate our own experiences if we notice something mathematical or linguistic or whatever. But what a difference when they come to that in their own full readiness. So I just wanted to say that I feel like math is not that different in that regard.
Which is what Peter Gray was saying. If I didn't read the article because I forgot to you, and I'm going to read it next. But from what you said, putting the maths on the pedestal.
Yeah. Well, you know what, and I kind of just wanted to finish to circle back to that, because at the beginning I had talked about, I got thinking, so let's say that being in the French immersion during those years kind of leading into secondary school, let's say that did impact my learning of math. I know it impacted my learning of history, because when I looked back at the topics that were covered in those years, I was like, oh, there's so much I didn't learn here. But it's kind of the idea, like, would I trade not having that French experience? And I think I wouldn't. I think the richness of, I wanted to be in that French program, and I enjoyed the French. I really did enjoy the French. And the math that I've needed, I feel I have figured out. I do a lot of math, actually, again, it's a pretty concrete way, but I do a lot of budgets with people in both organizations and individuals. So I do have to be thinking financially a lot, and I've had no trouble doing that. But it's like, did I miss out on some of that abstract stuff and it made it harder? Maybe, but I wouldn't trade the French. And so I just wanted to read a bit of a quote, and I'll leave out the middle of it because it's long. But Peter Gray starts by saying, the first step in coming to grips with math is to knock it off its pedestal. The real life problems that are important to us are problems like these. And he goes through a long list. And for example, the last couple are kind of philosophical things, like should corporations have the same constitutional rights as individuals? And then a practical one, what's the best way to unplug a toilet? So he says, math plays little, if any, in solving such problems, nor do such problems have clear-cut right or wrong answers, demonstrable by some formula. And this is the part I like right here. Human intelligence and reasoning reside in wisdom, not math. Wisdom is the ability to bring one's values, likes and dislikes, knowledge about other people and their likes and dislikes, and general knowledge of the world together in a manner that leads to workable solutions to the problems that confront us. Solutions that promote our own and others' happiness and decrease our own and others' miseries. Math has its purposes. Indeed, it has some valuable purposes in our modern world, but it is far from the core of intelligence. Humans were intelligent long before math was invented. Some of the smartest people I know, even some of the best scientists I know, are not particularly good at math. So I loved him talking about wisdom. Like, yeah, we're not compartmental, we're not reduced to these little subjects. It's really the bringing of things together. That's what we do when we solve problems, when we figure things out, when we kind of live our best lives. So yeah, I think I will link that article of his because it's quite extensive. Mm-hmm. But yeah, just this, the idea of knocking it off its pedestal, I kind of like that image.
And I think you can also include this book. I'll send it to you because that same essay is also in this little book. It's Peter Gray's book, How Children Acquire Academic Skills Without Formal Instruction.
Okay.
And I just loved it. It's just a whole bunch of small essays, but this put my mind at ease in so many ways, but especially around math and reading.
Okay, perfect. Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that sounds good. I think, and you know, it's. I keep saying we're gonna wind up here, but I think so often when we're thinking about learning something naturally, the assumption is that the assumption from sort of a mainstream way of thinking is that it's not being, almost like it's not being learned. Like we're saying, don't worry about it. You don't need to learn math because you're not going to use it anyway or whatever. And I think what's being missed is that in living in this really rich partnership that we have with our kids, they're actually being introduced sometimes to things to concepts they wouldn't even be exposed to in school. And they're being exposed to those in ways that are relative to their own life. So I think, I guess what I'm saying is, I think that there's this idea that an unschooling way of doing things is a lesser way of doing things, but it's kind of like, well, that's okay. How much of it do we really need anyway? Mm. And in fact, I think that, just the depth that kids can dive into things and also the breadth of things that kids are exposed to actually means that in many ways their learning has the opportunity to be really quite something. Not less than, just different. Yeah. Anything else that we should think about?
I think that's great. I love all of that. And I would just say, yeah, it's meaningful and it's lasting, right? We could teach them so many things that they will never remember, or we can teach them the things that matter to them in a way that they will, that will stick with them and stay with them and really build that foundation for a life of learning instead of, you know, memorize it and forget it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I feel like we could go on and on. So I'm going to just cut myself off right there.
We shall meet again if you're willing. Okay. So, yeah. Sue, anything, any other thoughts?
No, I didn't ask me that, Erin, because we'll be here another half hour.
Okay.
I've been writing down things we haven't talked about in eager anticipation that you're going to invite me back so I get to say them all next time.
Perfect. Okay. All right. Well, then we'll wind down for this conversation, and we'll look forward to meeting again, and hopefully the others will be able to join us too. And gosh, who knows? how long we might talk, but I will look forward to that. And then to anybody listening, I just thank you very much for being here. I will put in a little reminder that the Virtual Kitchen Table also has a community now. So I will link the information to the community in the notes, and we would love to have you become part of that as well. If these sorts of conversations sound like something that you're interested in, we do this as well in the community, and you'd be welcome to be part of that. So I will link that in the notes, as well as all the other resources that we've talked about. And thank you so much. We'll see you next time, Sue and April.
Thank you.
Thanks. Enjoy your day, Sue. Night, Erin.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And this ends our conversation today. We hope you found it interesting and maybe helpful. If you'd like to connect further or see additional content, Haley can be found on the web and on Instagram at Taking a Kinder Path. I, Erin, can be found at Everlearning, and Ashley can be found on Instagram at Ashley as Mama and Storytime Shelves. We'd be very grateful if you'd share this conversation with anyone you think might appreciate it. Thank you for your time today.